2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, and then 4 and 5. You must understand this, that in the last days distressing times will come, for people will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy. Verse 4, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, holding to an outward form of godliness, but denying its power, avoid them. We have a Christian heritage in our country. And when I say that, you know, I don't want to overstate that. I know that some of our founding fathers were deists and things like that, but it's hard to say that the Christianity has not had a major influence on our culture. But if at one time we were a Christian nation, as some have said, we are no longer. You know, I don't think there's any doubt that Christianity has had a huge influence over our culture. Many of the early colonies were founded by different Christian groups. You had in our history of the Americas, you had the first and second Great Awakenings, that the religion that has had the strongest form of influence on our culture is Christianity. Some of our most famous colleges, Harvard and Yale, were originally Christian colleges, founded primarily to be seminaries. You know, and I got to thinking about this some as I was watching the opening ceremony to the Olympics. You'd see Muslim nations walk in and, you know, dressed in Muslim garb. And then the U.S. walks in, and of course I'm rooting for the U.S. being an American, but, you know, I see them walk in, and there's a lot of them with their tattoos and their cell phones and everything else. And you know, I got to looking at them and thinking about most of those athletes are secular. You know, some of our athletes are devout Christians, and I'm very thankful for that. But I think those are really few and far between. We live in a secular society today. I was looking at some Gallup polls, some Gallup surveys, and in 2015, 70% of the people in our culture still claim to be Christian, and that includes Protestant and Catholics and those who consider themselves Christian unaffiliated. About 10 years earlier, a little bit over 10 years earlier, in 2002 through 2004, 81% identified themselves as Christian. And if you go back to 1960, that number was 92%. And so still we live in a culture today where 70% claim to be some sort of Christian. If you break that down, though, by age group, the 18 to 29-year-olds are the least religious group in our culture. But I was thinking about those stats, and the only stat that really didn't make sense to me was that 70% in our culture still claim to be Christian. Because if you look at mainstream culture today and Christianity, there's really little resemblance between the two. And I think one of the explanations is that we've got a lot of what some have called nominal Christianity out there. You know, you ask the question or you think about how can 70% of our population be Christians and close to 70% also believe that homosexuality is morally acceptable. Of course, today we have it moving, you know, where you're dealing with these transgender issues and other things. And there's a lot of people, that's just to say that there's a lot of people in our society that say if they're asked in a poll, they claim to be Christian. Yet it has little or nothing to do with their morality or the way that they live their lives. And you could easily divide it up. I mean, I remember when I was living in Dallas, and on Sunday mornings I'd go out and I'd visit different churches in that area as I was going to preaching school. And the only time I could get around easy in Dallas was on Sunday morning as I was driving to church. You know, the highways were empty. Maybe some of it is because people went to churches close to their home, but I don't think that's all that there was to it. But our society today, the U.S. today, is a very secular society. And I guess one of the questions for me that comes up is why? And I think that most people don't wake up one day and say, I want to be secular. I think it starts out kind of slowly. It starts out with hanging out with friends and getting involved with sports, or watching TV and watching movies, or listening to music, or going to college and pursuing a degree, or it can be trying to move up the ladder at work, or trying to figure out how you're going to make ends meet, or hanging out on Friday night, or adding new hobbies to your life and going out on dates. And many of these things are not necessarily wrong or bad in themselves. It's not really these things. It is the crowding out of the spiritual life as we get so involved in these activities and in the things of the world that the thing that's what sometimes happens is people get tied up in this and they get tied up in that and they get tied up on this other thing and they get caught up in their ambitions at work and things like that. And before very long, they stop reading the Bible. They stop attending church. They stop. Their prayer life kind of goes away. The problem is that spirituality and Christianity ceases to be an important part of their life. You know, I think some things, there are such things that are clear-cut, you know, that are wrong. You know, sexual immorality, cheating people to make money, and pride and selfishness. But kind of, I think, one of the temptations that is really as old as time is that all Satan needs to do is to distract us. I think of a passage in C.S. Lewis and his Screwtape Letters. It's a letter from this devil to this new devil, and this is a fictional account, and I understand it's fictional, but it's a letter from Screwtape to Wormwood, but he's given him advice on how to tempt this person. And he says to Wormwood, he says, murder is no better than cards if cards can do the trick. Indeed, the safest road to hell is the gradual one, the gentle slope, soft underfoot, without sudden turnings, without milestones, without signpost. And I think that that's insightful because it points out that one of the things or one of the dangers we can have is just when we let other things so occupy us that we start crowding out the spiritual life. And I think there's a danger of coming too at home in this world. And this was brought up this morning in our Bible class, but one of my favorite passages in the Old Testament is Deuteronomy chapter 8. But in Deuteronomy chapter 8, Moses is talking to that younger generation of Israelites that are getting ready to enter the Promised Land. Of course, the first generation died out in the wilderness except for Joshua and Caleb. But he starts out by recounting the wilderness experience. He says that God humbled you by letting you hunger and then by feeding you with manna, which neither you or your ancestors were acquainted, in order to make you understand that man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. The clothes on your back did not wear out, and your feet did not swell these 40 years. And then he goes on and he appeals to that younger generation about when they come into the land to keep the commandments of the Lord your God, walking in his ways and fearing him. And then he goes on to describe a danger and what might be a deceitful danger. He says, "For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land flowing with streams and with springs and underground waters welling up in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey, a land where you may eat bread without scarcity, where you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron and from whose hills you may mine copper. You shall eat your fill and bless the Lord your God for the good land that he has given you." Verse 11, "Take care that you do not forget the Lord your God by failing to keep his commandments." And then in verse 12, he says, "When you have eaten your fill and built fine houses and live in them, and your herds and your flocks have multiplied, and your silver and gold is multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, therefore do not exalt yourself, forgetting the Lord your God, who brought you out of the house, land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Do not say to yourself, 'My power and the might of my own hand have gotten me this wealth.' But remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the power to get wealth." That Deuteronomy chapter 8 warns that second generation, that generation entering the promised land, that they're going to face temptation when they get to the promised land, and when they settle in that land, and when the life there is good, they're going to face a temptation. You know, they've been going, they've been traveling through the wilderness for close to 40 years. And oftentimes when we talk about the tough times from a biblical standpoint, we talk about it in terms of a wilderness period. And the wilderness is supposed to be a challenging time, a tough time. And we all can represent, you know, times in our life that are tough, that we go through hardships. And we know those times are a struggle and hard sometimes to get through. But sometimes, from a spiritual standpoint, the wildernesses aren't all too hard. When they were in the wilderness, they depended upon God for manna and for quail. And when we go through wilderness periods in our life, sometimes that's when we're brought to our knees and we bow down and we give honor to God or ask Him to help us. But Moses warns them that it's going to be challenged when they get into their land, and when they have the grapes and the olives and the milk and the honey, and when their, you know, their herds and their flocks multiply, that one of the temptations, when everything is going good, they're going to be tempted to forget where these herds and these flocks and these riches come from. And they're going to be tempted to think that by my own hand I have acquired all of these things. I've heard it said, this expression used of Americans after World War II describing America as fat and happy. And we have lived and we continue to live in an affluent culture today. You know, I have concerns about America going forward. Our national debt is approaching $20 million, and I don't think, you know, there's not many people willing to make sacrifices to turn that around. But nevertheless, we do live in an affluent culture today, and I think we need to remember as Christians that affluence is not all good. That sometimes when we live in affluence, there's a tendency to forget the Lord our God. And it's kind of ironic, and I say ironic, but really it may not be ironic, but the places in the world where Christianity is growing the fastest is in the southern hemisphere, in the poorest countries of the world. that it's the poorest countries. And Tom recently mentioned this about Africa, but it's even true of Southern Asia and South America, certain places. And some of the poor countries is where Christianity is ripest and growing the fastest. But if you look at the cultures that have traditionally been Christian, like Europe and North America, that Christianity seems to be slowly dying off. I think that one of the things that happens is we get wrapped up in the created world. You know, everything that we have comes from God. And I think of that passage there in Deuteronomy chapter 8. He says, "Do not say to yourself, 'My power and the might of my own hand have gotten me this wealth.' But remember the Lord your God, for it is He who gives you the power to get wealth." But yet, I think so many times in practical life that when things are going good, we tend to not initially maybe forget our Creator, but we kind of cast Him aside, put Him to the side. We don't focus our lives on Him, and it's not too long and too many generations until so often we start to forget our Creator. Think of a movie I watched, and we're probably talking over 20 years ago now. The name of the movie was Man in the Moon. And I remember the mom in the movie was talking to a daughter and was saying that the father felt closer to God out on a lake than in a church building. But I was thinking about that, and you know, people do, and sometimes I think people do experience a closeness to God out in nature. But before long, we get caught up in this world in and of itself. You know, people go out fishing and find joy in fishing, but who made the lake and who made the fish? Or we have get-togethers and eating, and when we have all these get-togethers, whether they're family get-togethers or social get-togethers and things like that, and get together to eat, who made the cows? Who created the cows that we get the beef from? Who made the wheat that we use for flour to make the breads and the pie crust and the cakes and desserts? Our people in this world get wrapped up in sexual pleasures. But who made human bodies and who made human sexuality? And yet we take it out of its rightful place and its rightful purpose. In Timothy, he mentioned in that passage I read to begin, he mentioned lovers of money. And you think about everything that money can buy, whether it's land or houses or building. Who made the lumber that we build the houses with? Or who makes the metals and the steel? The materials we use to build fancy cars, it comes from God. It comes from this created world. Or we get wrapped up with social events and hanging out with friends, but where do these people come from? And whether they know it or not, or whether they acknowledge it or not, they're part of God's creation. And so, in effect, when we become worldly, we're getting wrapped up in this created world. And I do think that's part of what's happening in our culture today. I mean, we live in an affluent culture. And people are all getting wrapped up in the world and the things of this world. We have, you know, we have constant entertainment in our culture today. You can turn on the TV 24/7 and pick the channel of your choice. You can, you know, now today, and I've seen commercials on TV about this, but, you know, you have internet, and people can go on to the internet, and they can read just about anything. They can look up just about anything. They can watch videos on the internet and things like that. I mean, we have all this entertainment and stuff, and we have people pursuing, you know, they're pursuing good jobs. They're pursuing security, and they're wrapped up in this world, and I think that's what's happened. People are all wrapped up in this world, and we don't stop and give attention to God as we should. I think that is our culture today. People find enough happiness and contentment in this culture that oftentimes spiritual things really aren't that important to them. That as Paul talks about, that a lot of times in our culture today, and sometimes even people who would say give lip service to be Christians, that we become really too oftentimes lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. But to tell you the truth, I just don't get it. When people say that they just want to be happy, or when people spend their lives pursuing happiness and contentment, what it really means is they just want to be happy in the here and now. They want to be happy right now. I was just shy of my 22nd birthday when I came back to Christ. And for me, kind of like, you know, some of the things we're talking about, for me, you know, when I came back, it wasn't alcohol or drugs that I was coming back from. It was tennis and dating and movies and sports and video games and hanging out with friends. But when I was 22 years old, I thought, if this is all that life has to offer, then I didn't want it. I was 22 years old, and one of my favorite songs was the Eagles song, "After the Thrill Is Gone." And if going to concerts or playing sports or getting rich or hanging out and having fun is all there is to it, like I said, and like has been said, it's not much. And I don't want it. Soon we're going to study the book of Ecclesiastes on Sunday night. And I've always loved the book of Ecclesiastes. And some people find the book of Ecclesiastes very depressing. But I've always liked the book of Ecclesiastes. And I think of Ecclesiastes chapter 2, starting verse 1. The teacher says, "I said to myself, 'Come now, I will make a test of pleasure. Enjoy yourself.'" He says, "But again, this also was vanity. I said, 'Of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it?'" If life is all about the here and now and having fun, then he says, that's nothing. That's a vanity. That's a chasing after the wind. And I felt very much that same. Maybe it's my own life experiences. Maybe it was losing a brother when I was 15 years old and I saw my mom and the hurt that caused her. Or I went through a divorce when I was 22, and I'm sure a good share of that was my fault, but still, you know, I went through some things. At 24 years old, I did my first funeral, and it was a funeral for my grandmother, my last living grandparent that passed away. I had just graduated from preaching school, and my mom's oldest brother, my uncle, called me and asked me to do the funeral. You know, maybe some of it was my work as a minister in Archer City. It was an older congregation. I did quite a number of funerals in my 9 years at Archer City, and there, you know, there were members there that I got close to. And the transience of this life is something that I've always been aware of, something I've been aware of since I was young. I think of the passage in James that says, "Life is but a vapor, here for a short while, and then vanishes." And that's always resonated with me, even from back in my teens. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen at funerals, and if you go to funerals, sometimes you'll notice this or you'll see this. You know, you'll see spiritual people there, godly people who go to church all the time, and maybe they're the family members and they've lost their loved ones, and of course they're going through mourning and sorrow. And they come and they talk to the people, you know, that have come to the funeral. They're visiting with the, you know, the the church, and they're talking to the people that at the funeral home that are helping orchestrate the services, and they gather with their family, and it's hard. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's still hard to go by the casket that final time and to say your final farewell. But they believe and they have hope. And they know that God has something better prepared for us, and they're going to be okay. I mean, it's going to take weeks, it's going to take months, and grieving can go on for years, but they're going to be okay. But you also see people that go to funerals, family members that show up late and can't get out of the building quickly enough. That there's a lot of people in our society that can't deal with death at all. And I've noticed that through my years as a minister. And again, don't get me wrong, you know, after I did the funeral for my mom a few years ago, I got back home, and I don't remember if it was that night or a couple nights later, but I opened up a card from my former coworkers, and I just sobbed and I sobbed. But yet I had hope, and I looked forward to future. But there's people in our culture that they're so wrapped up in this world and this life, and that's what their focus is, and that's what their aim is, and I've seen them through the years in ministry that they just can't deal at all with the issue of death. And like I said earlier, James' statement that life is but a vapor resonates with me, and it's always resonated with me. You know, I'm soon to be 44, but it was something I was aware of at age 19 and at age 24. And to me, it seems completely ridiculous to put your stock in this world and the things of this world. It kind of reminds me of a study that's been done with children. They bring, you know, children into a room, and they'd offer them candy, and they said, you know, you can have this candy bar right now, or if you wait 5 minutes, you can have 2 candy bars. And get, you know, you end up getting twice as much if you just wait for 5 minutes. And a whole lot of the children, they'd take that candy bar right now, and then some of the children would say they wanted the 2 candy bars, and after about a minute or two, they'd give in, and they wanted that candy right then. They wanted to eat it right now. And this is small children. This is, I forget the ages, but, you know, like 4 or 5 or something like that. But they wanted it then. But I think in a lot of ways, our culture is like those children. We want it now. We want pleasure now. We want happiness now. And so I guess I have 2 kind of closing thoughts on the issue, and these thoughts aren't novel or new. But in an affluent culture like we live in, with lots of entertainment, there's a whole lot of people that are going to be lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. And for us, it may not be the same as those in the first century. It may not be chariot races or gladiatorial fights, but maybe it's movie theaters and football games. But at the same time, I do believe that there's a yearning in the human heart that nothing in this world can really satisfy. I think of what one of my teachers, Dr. Bill, used to say. He said, man is not made for time. Man is made for eternity. And even in an affluent culture, we still need God. And you see people going from marriage to marriage, or job to job, or hobby to hobby, thinking that finally this one is going to satisfy and give them the satisfaction, the happiness that they're longing for. And the truth is that none of these things can really satisfy the deepest longings of our heart. That some of the yearnings of the human heart will never be satisfied this side of heaven. And we are never going to get to heaven unless we seek after God and make Him a priority in our lives. If you haven't put God first in your life, there's no better time than now. We invite you to come while together we stand and we sing.